Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. But do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
What the First Nations people call Turtle Island, which is North America, is being transformed by those with the power to do it and the money to do it into one state, one economic structure. It's out of our hands now. It's been out of our hands for a long time. To explain what we're talking about economically, here's George Monbiot.
Okay, well, I'm going to start with a fairly straightforward observation, which has occurred to quite a few people, but we haven't done a great deal about it yet. And this is that just about everything on Earth has been globalized except for our consent. We've seen the globalization of power, the globalization of money, the globalization of culture, of language, but democracy remains confined to the nation state. And it stands at the national border with its suitcase in its hand, but without a passport permitting it to travel. And instead, as we know, the world is run by a self-appointed cabal of men from the rich world. They decide how everyone else is going to live. They call themselves Democrats. In some respects, however half-hearted it may be, at home they might be Democrats. On the world stage, they are dictators. What I'm going to try and describe is how we might make this democratic transition, how we might turn from what we now have, an age of coercion, to an age of consent. Now, the basic problem at the peak can challenge the rich and the powerful. If you look, for instance, at the United Nations, you see almost a perfect dictatorship. The 5 permanent members of the Security Council can block any decision made by every other member of the United Nations. Even if 190 members of the UN decide to do something, one country can decide that they're not going to do it. And that doesn't just apply to security, it applies to every substantial business within the UN. It's that they're encapsulated in Articles 108 and 109 of the UN Charter. And the result of that is that no decision ever gets made by the UN which is in the benefit of the poor unless it also happens to be in the benefit of the rich. If we look at the World Bank and the IMF, we see these institutions run on that time-honoured democratic principle of $1, one vote. The US alone has a complete blocking majority in both institutions. You need 85% of the votes in order to make a substantial decision within those institutions. The US has 17% in the IMF, 18% in the World Bank. It can stop anybody else from acting. And the result of that is that while they work almost exclusively in the poor nations, they are controlled exclusively by the rich nations. And there is nothing whatever that the people of the poor nations in which these institutions are more powerful even than those nations' own governments. There is nothing whatever that the people in the poor nations can do to try and change the way that they operate. So we have a situation in which the World Bank and the IMF have effectively complete dictatorial control over the countries in which they operate. We can look at the World Trade Organization, which in principle is a slightly more democratic body than the other ones, because in principle every nation has one vote. In practice, of course, before the General Assembly of the World Trade Organization meets to make substantial decisions, there are what are called green room meetings, convened by the European Union, the US, Japan and Canada, in which all the substantial decisions are made. They're then handed to the rest of the world on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. Here's our World Trade Agreement. Either you accept the whole thing with all its injustices intact, or you reject the whole thing knowing that the World Trade Agreement can then never work for you, the poor nations. Now, if there is anyone in this room, and I doubt it, who believes this is an acceptable way to run the world, then that's fine. That you're perfectly entitled to that position. Just do not call yourself a Democrat. If you believe in the principle of democracy, you must surely accept the need for radical change. Now, some people have responded to this dictatorship at the global level by calling for politics and economics to be dragged away from it and brought back to the national or the local level. And I can understand that position, I can sympathize with it, I used to be a supporter of that position. But I now see that it's an inadequate response for 2 reasons. The first one is that all the issues which people like us are most concerned about, such as debt and climate change and the terms of trade between nations and nuclear proliferation and war, can only be resolved at the international level. You can't resolve them just at the national and the local level. You've got to have some sort of global governance, or they get resolved purely by the brute force of the powerful. Okay, they are resolved by the brute force of the powerful at present, mediated slightly by these grotesquely flawed international institutions. But it's not a choice between having bad global governance or having no global governance, because no global governance is even worse than bad global governance. That is simply piracy and plunder. It's surely a choice between having bad global governance and good democratic global governance run by and for the world's people. The second reason why the localization approach by itself is inadequate is that unless you deal with the global situation and reclaim people power over global governance, then the existing global governance will just pick off our national and local solutions one by one. You cannot have national democracy without global democracy. This is what Lula found in Brazil. Before the election, Lula laid out some very ambitious plans for a complete economic transformation of Brazil, massively enhanced social spending, massively enhanced engagement in health and education and welfare policies of all kinds. Well, the IMF and the financial speculators came along and said, no way, you're not going to do that. You're going to have a budgetary return of between 5 and 6% a year, and there's absolutely no scope within that for the sort of social spending that Lula was talking about. So it's very clear that unless we can tackle this dictatorship at the global level, we might as well forget about trying to resolve national politics. I mean, why is it that in almost every nation on earth, the governing party and the principal opposition party are almost identical? There's virtually nothing to choose between them. The reason is the decisions are being taken elsewhere. They are not being taken at the national level. At the national level, we have democracy and no choice. At the global level, we have choice but no democracy. And that's what I want to try and address with this manifesto. In other words, it's not enough to think globally and act locally. We have to act globally as well. Our task is not to overthrow globalization, but to capture it and to use it as a vehicle for humanity's first democratic revolution at the global level. What we need to become is effectively the Chartists and the suffragettes of the New World Order. They brought democracy to the nation state. We need to do the same thing, but at the global level, to bring democracy to the world. And I've suggested in the book a number of means by which we might do this, looking at the world economy and world politics section by section. I don't have time to go into all of those means now. I'll just talk about the purely political ones. So I'm not going to talk about how to get rid of the World Bank and the IMF and how to transform the world's trade rules. That might come up in questions if we've got time. But I'm going to talk purely about what we do about the most overt means of global governance, which is, of course, the UN system and the way in which the powerful nation states use their leverage through that system and indeed avoid that system when it's more convenient for them to do so. Now, the problem with the UN is not just the Security Council. Even if you got rid of the Security Council tomorrow, it would still be a grotesquely undemocratic institution. There are three reasons for this. The first is that many of the nations represented there are not themselves democracies. The governments which turn up to make decisions at the UN have no claim whatever to represent their people. Even those which do claim to be democracies never canvass us before making a decision at the global level. And when was the last time our government ever said, right, we're going to have a referendum about a decision we're going to make at the UN? It just doesn't happen. The second reason why it's an inherently undemocratic body as it stands is it's absolutely riddled with rotten boroughs. And this is what the Peterloo Massacre, of course, was all about. That people were marching in order to get rid of rotten boroughs at the national level. These tiny little tiny little constituencies in which half a dozen people would elect an MP, whereas Manchester was completely unrepresented. Well, at the global level, we have exactly the same today. We have a situation where Tuvalu, a country of 10,000 people, has the same vote as India, a country of 1 billion people. Every Tuvaluan, in other words, is worth 100,000 Indians. And we have exactly the same problem now as we had at the beginning of the 19th century nationally. in that it's very easy, there's a very powerful incentive for the rich and powerful nations to bribe and blackmail the poor and the weak ones in order to buy their votes. And if the UN General Assembly had any real power, that would become a very major liability indeed. But the third reason is perhaps the subtlest, but it's also the most important. And this is that the UN has awarded itself three duties, but it's only in a position to discharge one of those duties. And the one it can more or less discharge is mediating between nation states when there's a conflict between them. It is, after all, a gathering of nation states. So it can it is in a position, perhaps a legitimate position, to try and sort out disputes which arise between them. But the other two, there's a massive conflict of interest which prevents its effective operation. If we look, for example, at its second function, which is to defend citizens from the oppressive power of nation states, there it simply, well, it functions only at one level. It functions only when a particular nation state is doing something particularly weird and anomalous. For instance, some really nasty ethnic cleansing. Then what you might see is the rest of the UN getting together, ganging up on that state and saying, you're doing something really bad there. But they're not going to gang up on each other. They're not going to gang up on themselves. So when every single nation state is doing something profoundly wrong, like spending a vast part of its national budget not on health and education but on defence spending, then they're not going to do anything about that because their interests are completely opposed to ours when it comes down to issues like that. They do not represent us. So they will not act. Similarly, the third function which is given itself is to represent the people of the world as a body, as a whole, above and beyond the level of the nation state. And again, it's woefully incapable of doing this. So, for example, one of the greatest menaces to public life at the global level is financial speculation. These leveraged hedge funds and other groups like that who go around the world ripping the money out of vulnerable countries and dumping it elsewhere, generally in offshore trusts, causing complete economic devastation and ruination in their wake. But these financial speculators are now the kingmakers of the existing world order. They're the people who decide whether governments stand or fall. If they don't like a government, they pull their money out of the economy collapses, the government collapses straight afterwards. So we can't expect a gathering of governments to turn around and do anything about the people who effectively sponsor them. The United Nations Charter begins with the words, "We the peoples of the United Nations." Well, that's a lie. It should begin with the words, "We the states." So what can we do about this? Well, it seems to me that there is some scope for reform within the UN when it comes to dealing with the functions it can discharge. And what I suggest is that, obviously, we get rid of the Security Council and vest its powers in the UN General Assembly. But having done that, there would be a desperate need to democratise and reformulate that assembly. And what I suggest is a way of introducing weighted voting so that a country is apportioned a vote according, first of all, to the size of its population to overcome the problem of rotten boroughs. Again, this was the key demand at the beginning of the 19th century that democratic movements made. Secondly, in order to overcome this problem of the undemocratic governments having just as much say in supposedly representing their people as the democratic ones, you would weight the vote according to where nations came on an index of democracy. Democracy measured not by processes, but by outcomes. Not just by things like freedom of speech and freedom of information, but also some economic democracy issues, such as equality. That the greater the level of equality within a nation, the greater its formal vote within the UN would be. And there are ways of measuring these things and ways of compiling democratic indices. And then you factor in, of course, a very powerful incentive for nation states to democratise at the same time as you're seeking to deal with the issue of global democracy. But of course, this only deals with those functions the UN can discharge. And this is why we need another body, a body which can represent the people of the world above and beyond the nation state. And this is why I'm calling for a world parliament. What I've suggested, and I've suggested the means in the book by which this could be done, is a parliament built from the bottom up, a parliament built from the grassroots actions we're already seeing worldwide being pulled together by the global justice movement. I've suggested that it can start with bodies like the World Social Forum, which then disseminate ideas and consultation worldwide in all the constituencies from which the people in those forums are drawn, and slowly, slowly begin to develop a directly elected parliament for the planet. And at first, this parliament wouldn't have formal powers. It would not be a legislature. It would not make rules and try to enforce them. Its purpose, initially at least, would be to hold the other international institutions to account, to draw up codes of good governance and then say to these other institutions, well, you seem to be breaching this code. What do you have to say about it? But that alone is a source of power, because what you see is that this parliament is the only institution at the global level which can claim to represent the world's people. It's the only one, therefore, which is directly legitimate. It's the only one with direct moral authority. And this puts other institutions in a difficult position. It could go to a body like the World Bank. Of course, the World Bank's not going to survive in this system, but say by some horrible fluke it did, it could go to a body like the World Bank and say, we've drawn up these principles of good governance, you are breaching them in the following ways, what do you have to say for yourself? And then that puts the bank in a difficult position, because either it can say, sod off, we're not talking to you, in which case it sacrifices credibility and legitimacy, or it goes along and says, all right, we'll go through the motions and we'll turn up and we'll account for ourselves. But of course, in doing so, it recognises the World Parliament's authority. It recognises its authority to hold it to account, and therefore it enhances the Parliament's ability to hold it to account next time. But that, I imagine, if such a thing was to start, would not be the end of the process. We could see, for example, these two bodies I've suggested slowly beginning to draw together. The UN would be re-legitimised by the fact that the Parliament can hold it to account. The members of the UN, in turn, would have a powerful incentive to encourage elections to the World Parliament, because in doing so, they rise up the Global Democracy Index and get a larger share of formal power. So you could therefore conceive of these two bodies gradually drawing together for a sort of gravitational attraction, and eventually forming a bicameral or two-chambered Parliament for the planet. And if that happens, then you can conceive of the powers which are currently held by the indirectly elected assembly.
Some people are sympathetic, some people are horrified by such a notion. I mean, God's sake, our own parliament's bad enough, the European parliament's bad enough, what on earth do we want a world parliament for?
Well, if you feel like that and I can sympathise, I would ask you to ask yourselves two questions. And the first one is this. What would you do instead? Not having a world parliament is also a decision. It's a decision to allow a few self-appointed men to continue to run the world. It's not a choice between a world parliament and no global governance. It's a choice between democratic global governance and undemocratic global governance of the sort we have today. The second question is this. Do you fear this idea because you feel it may subvert democracy? Or do you really fear this idea because you feel it might implement democracy a little bit too well? I mean, the implications are obvious. A resident of Kinshasa has the same vote as a resident of Brussels. The Ethiopians have the same amount of power as the Italians. The Mexicans, 2.5 times as much as the Spanish. The Indians, 17 times as many votes as the people of the United Kingdom. Could it be that for all your radical and liberal self-image, somewhere deep in your heart of hearts, you fear and resent this outcome? This idea of the world order which has served us in Britain so well. The world order in which, in terms of our economy, it's led to enormous wealth being unfairly transferred into the hands of Britain, not, of course, all the British people. It's permitted us not to have our revolution. Because if it weren't for this massive artificial infusion of wealth, we would have to take on our ruling classes. We would have to force them to let go of some of their wealth, because there wouldn't be enough for anyone at the bottom at all. As it is, we have benefited enormously from this predatory colonial economy. But of course, if we were to have genuine global democracy, we would no longer be able to do that. And I find this in myself. I find myself mouthing these words of, we need this massive transfer of power, we need a redistribution which permits the poor nations to converge with us. And it sounds great in my head, but still somewhere there's that shadow in the heart of, do we really want to let go? Do we really want to allow other nations to become more powerful than we are
other peoples to become more powerful than we are. Well, this is just one of the suggestions that I've put forward, but already you'll see that it sounds ridiculously optimistic and idealistic. I mean, it's, you know, we seem to be stuck with a world in which Bush and Blair and one or two other people like that make all the decisions. How on earth can we transform this into a world in which the world's people make the decisions, in which the poor effectively become more powerful than the rich? Well, I have to say that until March of this year, I was pretty well stumped. I could see how there were some means of changing the World Trade Organization, for example, but these big, all-powerful bodies like the UN Security Council, what on earth could you do about them? I mean, the members of the Security Council can veto any attempt to challenge their veto. They can use the UN Charter to prevent any change to the UN Charter. How on earth do you deal with something like that? And there I was, frowning and puzzling over this, and my deadline was running out, and I was getting towards the end of the book, and what on earth could you do? And then, like the cavalry, our newest and foremost ally comes over the hill and comes to the rescue. This is a man who spent the past 2 years making the case for the global justice movement, demonstrating just how critically important it is that we have democracy at the global level. And this man is, of course, George W. Bush. Now, before the Iraq War, there was a lot of comment in the papers, before and indeed during and then after especially, a lot of comment in the papers suggesting that Bush had actually been misunderestimated. that we had imagined the man was a moron. And how could this possibly be true? Because look, he had really made it happen. He got into Iraq, he said what he was going to do, and look what a paradise he's made the place today. This is the mainstream version of history being written in front of our eyes. Well, let me tell you that Bush is a registered moron. The men who built the world order that we are now suffering under, the men who built this dictatorial world order, were very savvy political operators. Roosevelt, Truman, and the men who surrounded them, they really knew what they were doing. And they recognized very clearly that if the US was going to sustain its hegemonic power, not just for a few years or a few decades, but for a very, very long time indeed, it would need other countries to help it to do so. You had to effectively recruit other countries to do much of your work for you. And in order for that to happen, you had to convince them that they were part of the global governing project. You had to hand out a few seats in the Security Council so that they could feel that they were on the inside looking out, not on the outside looking in. A few votes in the World Bank and the IMF. Trading rights within GATT and within the World Trade Organization. Enough of a say to make it look, at least to your people, as if you were a real participant on the world stage. But Bush is greedy. He wants it all, and he wants it now, and he doesn't understand why he has to make any concessions to anyone. He's basically shutting down many of the institutions which were set up specifically to sustain his dominance, because he's greedy and because he's blinded by that greed. And in doing so, he presents the other powerful nations with a very stark choice. He's effectively saying to them, either you accept direct global governance from Washington. From now on, you're cut out completely. You have no say at all in the way the world is run. You sit back and watch while we in Washington make all the decisions. We go to war when we want to go to war. We drop bombs when we want to drop bombs. We ruin economies when we want to ruin economies. Either you accept that or you do something about it. That is a choice which Bush has given these nations. And already nations are finding themselves forced to do something about it. We've seen this with the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, with the International Criminal Court. They've set up these institutions in defiance of the US. They're now going to be forced to set up new security institutions, new financial institutions, new trade institutions, because the US is destroying the other ones, and they know full well that from their point of view, the only thing worse than having the wrong institutions is having no institutions at all at the global level. They're being forced to act. But they can only act against the world's great national superpower if they can recruit the other great global superpower onto their side. And of course, that other great global superpower is world public opinion. In other words, us. And this puts us in a potentially powerful position. Because while we might expect those nations, and they are now most of the nations of the world, who want to contain American power, to try to create a new world order which also suits them and not us. In other words, something quite similar to the sort of world order we've got now, which is effectively run by the nation states rather than by the citizens of the world. Under these circumstances, when they're really up against it, when they're up against a very great problem in the shape of the United States, if they're to have any sort of radical change in the way the world order is conceived, then they're going to have to demonstrate that, that they've got massive and unstoppable political backing. And that makes them much more vulnerable to the sort of proposals which we put forward than they have been in the past. But this isn't our only source of power by any means. In fact, some of the other sources are even more powerful than this, and I would suggest that perhaps the greatest of all lies, paradoxically, in the hands of the poorest and most vulnerable nations. We often are told that if you owe the bank $1,000, you're in trouble, and if you owe the bank $1,000,000, the bank is in trouble. So what if you owe the bank $2.5 trillion? What if you own the international financial system? You suddenly see that debt, which has always been portrayed as a liability, is in fact a massive and insuperable asset. It is a weapon which can be pointed at the heads of the financial markets and to make demands for a massively changed international order. Now, the great thing about possessing a terrifying weapon, like the possibility of a mass collective default on the debt if you don't get what you want, in other words, a sort of reversal of what's done today where the World Bank and the IMF attach conditionalities to new loans. In this case, you have the poor world attaching conditionalities to any sort of debt repayment in the future. The great thing about possessing a terrifying weapon like this is that you can let the terror do the work for you. And of course, nowhere does fear do its work more effectively than in the financial markets. These are people who flee from their own shadows. And as soon as they realize that you're serious, that you're really intending to use this weapon, you're really intending to default, you're really intending to show that capitalism is a great big pyramid scheme, which eventually has to be brought to its senses by the fact that you cannot continue to issue debt indefinitely. As soon as you show that you are serious about this, what you then discover is that the financial markets, who have formerly been your great enemies, start to work on your behalf. They turn to their own governments and say, for God's sake, do something, because these people are serious and we will be destroyed if you don't act. And this is political judo. This is the way you recruit the weight and the strength of your opponents to start doing your work for you. This is the way you divide and rule the existing world order. Now, of course, none of this can happen. None of this can possibly happen without massive concerted campaigning by the world's people. And already we see in the form of the global justice movement the biggest political campaign the world has ever seen at any point in history. But it's my belief that this almost inexorably is destined to become bigger and bigger. Because what we see happening is the space, the necessity for its further growth being created by the very institutions to which we are opposed. The forces of economic globalization, again, seem to be doing our work for us without us even asking. Economic globalization is ripping down the barriers which have previously held people apart, the economic barriers, the political ones, the cultural ones, the linguistic ones. It's clearing the space. It's creating the political discontent on which all new politics must feed, because it forces governments to act on behalf of big business and capitalism instead of acting on behalf of their people. It's effectively creating a global demos, a global citizenship, by ensuring that all over the world, people are oppressed by the same institutions and the same forces. We no longer see the fate of the people of Bangladesh as being completely different to our own, because we know what Monsanto and Shell and the other big multinationals are doing to them, and we know that it's very similar to what they're doing to us. At the same time, these forces of economic globalization are handing us the weapons that we need to gather and coordinate our attack. They're developing the communications and transport networks necessary for a global revolution. The dictatorship of vested interests, in other words, has created the means of its own destruction. But it's done more than that. It's given us the opportunity to change the world. Thank you.
You'll notice he said Parliament should be built from the bottom up, from the grassroots, and that's the only way it's going to happen because we are the majority. That G20 summit showed us exactly what's going on. The money bring out the SWAT and the dogs, the weapons, against its own people for what reason? So it can have its meetings in secret? So it cannot listen to the voices of the people that are trying to live under the regime? I thought I would never say a word like regime and one world order. But I'm watching it crawl up North America with the major highway coming up from Laredo, Texas, branching off into places into Canada and the tar sands. Wherever the pipelines go and the refineries go, the roads follow. Suddenly there's a change in Hamilton, a change that people thought they had beaten. Things don't stay the same. We have an election. It's a quick election, but sudden decisions are being made, like the Atropolis taking the agricultural land and turning it over to WestJet. Why would that happen? Why do we need to do that right before an election? And why is Larry Deanney coming back into the picture to stand for mayor? This is a man who broke laws, who seems not to be bothered by it. This is a man who has connections, who will give in to Rhodes without realizing what's going on with the climate. There is another man, Bill McGibbon, who has written many, many books, who you may have heard on the David Letterman show. He started the 350.org organization last year, and it's all over the world. What happens? People get together and try and bring that carbon CO2 released into the atmosphere back down to a level that we can maybe deal with, 350 parts per million. But already we've melted the ice peaks. Already we've melted the glaciers. That's our fresh water. That's what we use to drink. Already the climate has changed so bad that places in the world where we get our food can't produce that food. And yet we give agricultural lands and lands that we have left in between all the cookie-cutter subdivisions, something we should stop doing, something we should have stopped doing 20 years ago. Again, we want to give this land over to WestJet, over to a fossil fuel industry, where trucking and air freight go back and forth across the country. Why is this decision all of a sudden? It has something to do with the Mid-Penn Highway suddenly being forced across Canada. There was some doubt it would happen, and then somebody behind the scenes gave the go-ahead, and it's happening. Hamilton will be affected. How do we know this? WestJet suddenly got 2,500 acres of farmland to put warehousing on. There is a site on the web that is telling people from all over the world to come to Canada and pointing out all the places that they can live and hiding our dirty little secret like the tar sands. It took James Cameron, a movie producer, to come up and look at the tar sands to strike fear into the heart of the oil company. The CBC did an in-depth documentary and showed everything that was going on with the tar sands, and nothing changed, nothing happened. But James Cameron, a big movie producer, comes for 3 days at the invitation of the First Nations, who say, we can no longer drink our water, we can no longer eat our food. The look on his face was shock when he delivered his press speech. He looked stunned. Appalled. He knows it must stop. If the market of parts per million before the temperature rises too far up the scale for us humans to live on the earth, then the game is lost. We have to fight. We don't have any choice. Last year, the parts per million was 370. This year, the parts per million was 390. We've moved up so fast, so far. That's why we are seeing the environmental disasters from all over the world. Now, if we're getting our food from China and it's flooding, what are we going to eat? We can't feed our citizens now. We don't have enough farmland left. the subdivision has been sneaking in across the countryside. And while we in the lower city argue about certain things in poverty, we have no idea what's going on back over the mountain. We cannot gain control of poverty if we don't gain control of the global corporations that are dictating what's happening in North America, literally. They know that the waters are going to flood, and it's going to rise at least 30 feet on each coast. That's why they're building this central corridor up from Laredo, Texas, right to Winnipeg. They know the coasts are going to flood, and they want to do business as usual with the South America countries, Chile, Argentina, Mexico. And they want that port in Churchill, Canada, tiny little town. The ice to people like Stephen Harper is just something that's in the way. We have to get rid of it. We have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on military expenditures so we can defend that front while our people starve in the streets, while we lose jobs constantly. Why did Stephen Harper sell off Crown property via rail? Why is he putting money into that infrastructure? Well, the answer is get rid of the ice, have more ships come in from Russia, and they bring grain. And they buy our grain. But if our grain is being flooded before it has a chance to ripen, or it's being burnt up into the field so it didn't have a chance to become useful, then it all means nothing. Our leaders are missing the most important point with climate change. They're not thinking ahead. They can't see ahead. They don't go outside. They don't mingle with reality, and they're greedy. Our environment is changing too fast for human beings to live. That's it. And if we don't find a way to bring down CO2 really fast to stop adding to the problem, then control and money mean nothing. What we need is land. We need to control the land so we can grow food, so we can eat. On October the 10th, 2010, a handful of members from the group 350.org went up to the lands across from the airport, and they planted garlic cloves into the shape and design of the number 350. They were making a point. That's good agricultural land. And we get our garlic from China. If you want to find out more about 350.org, simply go to 350.org on your computer. Bill McKibben is the leader. He's written some amazing books. And that's McKibben, spelled K-I-B-B-E-N. You may remember him from the David Letterman Show. Educate yourselves. Go to the library and read the books. Listen to independent radio. And get active. If all you do is paint a sign, get active. Here are some clips from Hamilton's 350.org campaign.
Sorry. It's just parts per million, molecules per million in the atmosphere.
So today you chose garlic. Can you explain the significance of that?
Yeah, the action we chose today, we planted garlic in the shape of a 350 out on land where Hamilton is planning to build an airport and build an industrial site. And if
today is 10-10-10, and that's a specific interesting number to a group called 350.org. And you want to explain why that number is important?
Yes, 350.org was organized a little over a year ago. It was all started by a guy named Bill McKibben and his just a couple other people, actually. And from that, it's generated into groups all over the world doing actions. Last year, the one was on October 24th. This year, we've picked 10-10-10 just because it's a significant sort of number. But 350, what it stands for, is 350 parts per million of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And that's significant because it's been scientifically proven that we need to bring it down to that number in order to keep the world stable. Where we are now is up around 390. And they're projecting that it will go up within the next, I don't know how many years, but like next little while to like as far as 450 if we can continue on our track, at which point we're going to see huge impacts like floods and
glaciers melting. Now,
yes, yeah. Which at 390, we're already seeing some of the things that they projected we'd see at 450, right?
And this is just carbon dioxide.
It's just parts per million, molecules per million in the atmosphere.
So today you chose garlic. Can you explain the significance of that?
Yeah, the action we chose today, we planted garlic in the shape of a 350 out on land where Hamilton is planning to build an airport and build an industrial site. And if this project goes through, it's called the Aerotropolis, if it goes through, we will be taking out 2,500 acres of prime local agricultural land in Hamilton. And one of the things we need to do in order to, you know, get the number back down to 350 is obviously cut carbon dioxide going into the air. And so we need to quit having trucks shipping food. We need to bring everything more local, have everything done local, and get, you know, things off the road.
Okay, so just explain the importance of using garlic. And I understand that we don't have any garlic here in Canada, running low. Why is that?
Because it's not being grown locally. As far as I know, most of the garlic it's a very easy thing probably to grow in our climate, but we're bringing it in from China instead. If you go to the grocery store, you'll see most of the garlic comes from China, some from the U.S. But anyway, that was why garlic, because it is one of the items that would be so easily grown locally, and most of it's coming in from China, which is ridiculous. You know, so you've got the shipping and the carbon.
Don't forget your shovels.
It is the accordion bus.
Yeah.
Midwest or the North China plane, neither one of those, if they had that plane in Moscow,
And here we are in Hamilton, giving up 2,500 acres, maybe up to 5,000 acres. The city doesn't want to tell us how many acres they're urbanizing, but at least 2,500 acres of farmland are being lost because they're a crop disease at all.
Only the most recent. There was a tariff actually put in place to try and prevent this Chinese garlic from chasing Ontario garlic out of the market. And the garlic started coming in from the Philippines. We get a lot of Mexican stuff. We get a lot of... much of our food comes from California. It comes from the U.S., but... we are seeing stuff that's coming from overseas, but even stuff that's coming from California. California is in pretty desperate straits in terms of water. And they are also getting hit by significant heat waves that are certainly damaging the crops as well. So in all the situations, we become really dependent on food from everybody else. And we think we can just give up our farmland and it's okay, and the food will just keep coming, and it won't. And at the end of the day, in the same way as freedom of the press belongs to those who own one, the freedom to eat belongs to those who have farms.
From TomDispatch.com, this is TomCast. Interviews and insight from TomDispatch contributors for anyone seeking a deeper understanding of our post-9/11 world and a clear sense of how our global imperial system actually works. I'm Timothy McBain. This week I had the pleasure of speaking with author, educator, environmentalist, and founder of 350.org, Bill McKibben, about his recent TomDispatch article, "We're Hot as Hell and We're Not Going to Take It Anymore." The anger that you're expressing in this piece has come from over two decades of working to try to fight the causes of climate change. Why isn't there this anger in the political world, in mainstream media, and is it surprising?
Oh, I don't know whether it's surprising or not. I just think that the time has come where we have to speak plainly about the problem that we're facing. You know, climate change is happening and happening very quickly in places all around the world, including right here at home. We're in the hottest year we've ever faced, in the end of the hottest decade we've ever come through. We've got to finally get to work, and the fact that our political system refuses to do so is troubling in the extreme. And pretending that it's not so doesn't seem to be helping. So let's actually say what the trouble is, that the planet is warming up, say what we need to do, disrupt the business model of the fossil fuel industry, and see if we can rally enough people to make that happen.
Last winter, it seemed that the only people that were pointing out the absurdity of this were people like John Stewart, but he noted that on a lot of mainstream media, they were giving a platform to people who were arguing because it's snowing in D.C., there must not be global warming. But I didn't hear anybody saying this summer, oh, because it's really hot, I guess global warming is really a fact we're going to have to deal with.
Look, there's no getting around the fact that the other side, the side of the fossil fuel industry and the side of climate denialism, has its own TV network at Fox, and that is a useful thing to have, and that the rest of the media has been stuck in this kind of weird false balance for 20 years, even though science has long since figured out what's going on. We got to stop waiting for the media to do the job and start doing it ourselves with real organizing. That's what we do at 350.org. Hopefully we'll be able to build that movement bigger and stronger.
And as far as the tools that you use to organize, can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. We use art and music. We use political anger. We use the Internet. Last year in October, we coordinated what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history, 5,200 separate demonstrations in 181 countries. This October, we're heading for a global work party with actions all over the world designed to not only do good things in local communities, like put up solar panels or lay out bike paths, but also to send a pointed political message to our leaders. We're getting to work. What about you?
Yeah, and can you talk a little bit about that? Because you do mention it in your article, setting an example for the politicians.
Yeah, I'm afraid that the time has come to, if nothing else, shame these guys a little bit for not getting to work. And one way to do that is to demonstrate what work looks like. We'll be spending the weekend with shovels and hammers in our hand, and when the end of the day comes, we will put down the shovel or the hammer and pick up the cell phone and place the call, and maybe the kind of angry call to our senators, congressmen, kings, politburos, whatever it is we have, wherever we are around the world, saying, look, we're hard at work, time for you to do the same.
Guest has been called our nation's leading environmentalist and is the author of this bestseller entitled Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Please welcome Bill McKibben, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for being here. I learned a couple of, important things from reading this book. First of all, the title now, in retrospect, is nearly self-explanatory, but tell people why the changing of the spelling of the word Earth.
Why the extra A? Well, the planet is a different place than the one we were born onto. Not completely. There's the same number of continents. Gravity still works. But it's a warmer place, a lot warmer. This summer gives you some sense of what that feels like in
its
early stage.
And when it heats up like this, is that, in fact, an indication of climate change?
Absolutely. So far this year, the federal government just reported that we've seen the warmest 6 months, the warmest year, and the warmest decade on record. Mm-hmm. 19 nations set new temperature, all-time temperature records this summer. We talked with our colleagues in Pakistan in May. We were on the phone with them one day. And they said, people in Pakistan don't normally complain about the heat. It's often hot there. But they said, today's hot. How hot? Well, we just set the new all-time Asia temperature record, 129 degrees. So, you know, wow. New York today, this afternoon, it was 95. Turn that up 35 and then take away most of the air conditioning. And that's what Pakistan was like in May before it started having the worst flooding that it had ever seen.
I used to think that that maybe there was and by the way, this people say it happened in the early 80s, but truthfully it began with the Industrial Revolution. Is that a safe enough assumption? And it's all about carbon parts per million in the atmosphere.
We started learning to burn coal and gas and oil, and every time we do, we put some more CO2 mm-hmm. in the atmosphere. For a long time, not enough to make a difference, but by the late 1980s, I wrote the first book about climate change in 1989. By then, it was beginning to tell. frankly, it's happened more quickly than we expected, even in the last two decades.
Right. And what is the mark? Years and years and years ago, it was 229 parts per million of carbon dioxide. What is it now?
It was 275 all through the what we call the Holocene, the 10,000 years of human civilization. Now it's about 392, mm-hmm. and that's bad news because about 2 years ago, our best climatologist, James Hansen at NASA, told us, they published a paper saying, any amount of carbon in the atmosphere more than 350 parts per million CO2 is not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted.
Right. I mean, and so that's we've surpassed that.
Yes.
Now, when will we be walking around saying, "Ooh, boy, too much carbon"? When is that gonna?
That's what they're saying. Even if they don't know it, you know, yeah. In Russia this summer and in Pakistan this summer, you know, those floods come because warm air holds more water vapor
right.
than cold.
And in terms of the frequent and seemingly more frequent shift in the seismographic. Earthquakes, what I'm trying to say. Is that a manifest of this, or is that completely a different...
Earthquakes and volcanoes are probably the two things we've actually left alone, more or less, mm-hmm. on this planet. They're still close to being acts of God.
They have nothing to do with the ambient temperature.
There may be more earthquakes happening in Greenland, because as that ice drops, as it melts quickly, there's a lot of weight coming off the landmass there, and that's increasing some seismic activity. But the big problems are rising sea level, mm-hmm. endless heat waves. Russia this year announced that it wasn't going to be sending any grain anyplace else in the world. No grain mm-hmm. exports at all because the hot weather is interfering with their ability to grow.
So the other thing that I've learned from this book, which I suspected all along, is that there's really, we're not going to put these pieces back in place. We're not going to cool the oceans. We're not going to rebuild the ice caps. We're not going to change. We're not going to push the tropical climate back toward the tropics. All of this is out of the bag, not going back in.
Well, half right. We're not going to stop global warming.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. On the other hand, everything that I've described so far happens with raising the temperature of the planet about 1 degree. That's what we've done so far. The climatologists are quite clear that unless we get our act together, i.e. get off fossil fuel very soon,
right.
that number will be 4 or 5 degrees.
But that's not going to happen because, as you point out in the book, let's just say, for an example, let's shift to nuclear power, the hated, dreaded nuclear power. Well, not a bad idea, except we can't really afford it. It's billions and billions and billions of dollars to get a reactor up and online.
Nuclear power is expensive. We're going to have to spend a lot of money to make the transition, probably most cheaply to mm-hmm. sun and wind, and we're going to have to do it in an all-out basis. It's
right.
not going to be easy.
Well, here's another statistic that you point out in the book. 80% of Americans drive cars. 80% of 300 million people are driving cars. 6 or 8% of Chinese, a billion people, are driving cars. What will happen when 80% of that number is driving cars in China?
If that happens, then we're out of luck. The Chinese, the Chinese right now have about the same car ownership that we had in 1922.
Right.
So there's a lot of room for...
Everybody will like to have a car one day there.
The good news is that the Chinese, frankly, are doing more than we are.
About right.
I was 2 months ago doing a piece for the National Geographic. I was in China at the headquarters of the guy who's installed 60 million solar panels. 250 million Chinese, when they take a shower, the hot water is coming off the sun-heated panels on the roof.
I know a guy 20 years ago, he said to me, I'm heating, this is in Southern California, I'm heating my pool. He took a length of garden hose, ran it up on the south slope of his house, and pumped the pool water up through there, and in a couple of days, the damn pool was so steamy hot he couldn't stand it.
I know another guy, Jimmy Carter, who 31 years ago this summer installed solar panels on the White House roof, only to see them taken down during the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
We're taking one of those panels back. It's been at the top of Unity College in central Maine for 30 years. We're taking them back down to the White House next week, saying, please, it's time to put these back up.
Right. And what do you think will happen then? Are they going to say, okay, just get in line, or what are they going to say?
I think that they'll probably be eager to do it. Look what happened when Michelle planted the garden, you know.
Well,
the next year,
right.
seed sales went up 30%.
That's right, but the planting a garden doesn't threaten the oil
that.
And gas that is running this.
There is that.
Yeah. Okay, we'll be right back with Bill McKibben, ladies and gentlemen.
Come on, children.
This has been The Other Side. I am your host, Maggie Hughes. Thanks for listening. Redefining Radio.
Syncopate Radio.